United States and China, neither are going away, neither are going to, you know, give up in this conquest. So it is, you know, how do we find a way to work together that can really serve humanity?
USSR was the first to support India on its way to freedom. Cooperation between the countries expanded rapidly across multiple spheres.
The sensation of Bollywood and Indian culture gripped the Soviet Union.
Both countries had each other's back in times of need.
We shared the joy of conquering space.
Over time, Russia and India recognized each other as special and privileged partners.
We both strive for a fair and more equitable world.
And both are driving global change, shoulder to shoulder. RT India, the story has a new voice.
And welcome to Worlds Apart. In realist terms of great power competition, security always trumps economics. That's why trade was the first victim of the proxy conflict between Russia and the Western Ukraine, or the current power play between the United States and China. What will be left of the global economy after the great powers have had their way with it? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Cyrus Jensen, an American geopolitical analyst and YouTuber. Cyrus, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me tonight.
I think it's fair to describe you as a cosmopolitan American or a citizen of the world of the U.S. origin, so you're the right kind of guy to ask this question. Donald Trump is generally believed to represent the part of America that was left behind by globalization, and he pledges to rectify this mistake and try to make America great again. In your view, how well he's doing in this regard?
Well, I have to be honest. I think that Donald Trump is very much struggling in his goal of making America great again. Actually, there was a Harvard professor that came out with an amazing article this week that said, if you take away the AI data centers being built in the United States, that the real GDP growth for the United States so far for the first half of 2025 would be 0.1%. So we're actually not seeing economic growth. We've seen the tariffs absolutely cause a tremendous amount of inflation, a lot of price increases. And so for the average American, they are struggling very much in this economy. And so you certainly have people that have money, and you know the upper class is fine, as they are in most economies, whether it's an up or down time. But for your average American, very much struggling at this point.
I agree with you that it's all about how you measure success. And if you take disruption as a measure of success, then at least the Trump administration has been working hard. And I think we also need to give it a due credit, because they, you know, called a spade on some issues that were a no-go to the previous administrations. At least he, you know, stated some obvious truths, but in terms of bringing tangible benefits to the Americans he claims to represent, you know, it is an open question of how much he has done, at least as we look at the American debt problem or some other economic indicators. What do you think?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that's a great question. And I think, what I want to start off with this trade war is that, you know, Trump's goal is actually a noble one, right? He wants to actually bring back jobs to America. He wants to increase employment in the United States. He wants to see manufacturing come back to America. And this is a message that many Americans are on board with. But when you actually talk to real businessmen and you talk to real economists, they just fail to see how that plan that Donald Trump is implementing, how that's going to result in, like you said, the tangible benefits for Americans. You know, these jobs have been shipped out of America for the past 30 years, predominantly most of them going to China, for example, for manufacturing. And the simple reality is that China can produce very high quality products at extremely affordable prices. And we're just not in a position where, even as Americans, where we can really support buying local, because you can get a much better product from China directly, and it's just going to save you money. Everybody wants to buy local. Everybody wants to buy American until it actually comes to the point of you making the purchase. And there was a very interesting case study with an entrepreneur in the United States who makes shower heads. And he actually did a test. He said, I'm going to make a shower head in America, and I'm going to compete it against my shower head in, you know, from China. And so same company, same branding. And the problem was, is that the American-made shower head was nearly four times the expense of the Chinese-made one. So he ran a test. He did a huge weekend special, and he sold 3,500 new shower heads that weekend for the special promotion. Not a single one was purchased. Not a single customer purchased the American one. They actually all purchased the Chinese one, because why? It was 25% of the cost and a similar quality. So again, it's a great idea, but on paper, and on paper, it's a great idea. In the real world, it just doesn't actually work.
Well, Cyrus, I think it also depends on the cost that you're willing to bear, because take the example of Russia. We are essentially cut off from the Western economic infrastructure right now. So we were forced into the position when we have to, create that manufacturing base in our own country. And yes, we have to pay a premium, but, there are also advantages to that, because you have to take into account employment, you have to take into account the influences of people having jobs on, on the social climate, on their psychological and mental health, on the safety of the cities. I mean, it's not only about the quality and the price of the product, is it? It's also about, some larger social things that you have to take into account as you plan your industrial policy.
Correct. Oh, I would agree with that. I think in Russia's situation, I could definitely see, that shift that had to happen. And, higher costs is just part of that problem, unfortunately, for Russia at that time. But, for the United States, it just comes down to American consumers. At the end of the day, they want to buy the best quality product they can for the best price. And this is why, for example, Chinese electric vehicles, it's currently banned in the United States. You're not allowed to bring those in. There would be a tremendous amount of tax and on that. And, the United States is very clear on that. Because the Chinese produce the best electric car in the world at the best price point. We've seen this throughout Europe. For example, I just made a video about BYD and how they're crushing sales in the United Kingdom. Sales are up 880% this last month compared to a year before. And there's a tremendous amount of momentum going, because the people in the UK, very excited about finally being able to get this technology. And in the United States, there's definitely wanting to protect that industry, right? You look at Ford, GM, these very big car companies in the United States, they absolutely would crumble, if the Chinese electric vehicles were to come into this country, just because at the end of the day, American consumers, they want the best price. They are very much interested in price. And that's how I see this economic battle happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say before that Trump's inconsistency with tariffs makes it more difficult for U.S. companies to do business. And we usually think of U.S. corporate world as having a lot of influence on American politics, big pharma, big tech, big food companies usually, get what they want from the White House. Has that been the case with this administration so far? Is Trump amenable to this kind of pressure?
Well, I think the issue with Trump is that, there's a lot of inconsistencies and a lot of speculation for what's going to come from the White House. We don't really know what he's going to do. And the problem is he changes courses very quickly. Even my work as a geopolitical analyst, sometimes stories are changing by the day, even down to the hour, because, for example, he started a tariff war with our closest ally, our closest neighbor, Canada. Canada is the best neighbor any country could ask for, a very peaceful country, does a tremendous amount of trade. Let's not forget, we share a 4,000-mile border with the Canadians. And Canada has always supported the United States. And so all of a sudden, Donald Trump says, we're going to introduce 20% tariffs. Now it's going to be 50. Okay, now it's back down to 20. Okay, we're going to get rid of it. We're going to do 30 days. No, back to 50 now. So, imagine all of the industries that are, working between the United States and Canada. It's very confusing. And for companies, you need to give guidance. You know, what is our fourth quarter going to look like? What is 2026 going to look like? How are we going to forecast the future? And there's so many different variables that companies are trying to predict. And unfortunately, in the business world, it makes it very, very difficult when you have a president that is constantly changing policies. Even with China, you know, we've seen the United States, you know, threaten very much. Okay, we're going to go up to 200% tariffs. We're going to go to 250% tariffs against China. And then what happened in April this year? The stock market crashed four consecutive days, huge, huge losses. People were losing tons of money, very frustrated. And then immediately the United States had to pivot.
I'm an outsider, certainly not a professional, or specialist when it comes to American politics or economy. But I think it's very hard to have a rational policy when it comes to the United States, because your system in and of itself is a very strange animal. I know that Americans pride themselves on having the best system in the world, but it's based on so many conflicting and sometimes outdated beliefs that it's very hard to reform it. And many successive administrations have tried to do that to a very, very limited success. Usually they limit themselves to rhetorical or cosmetic changes. Do you think the Trump administration is an outlier in this regard, or is it just like everybody else before it?
Well, I think, to be honest, you know, with the United States government and our policy, I'm going to say an interesting thing here. I mean, I'm born and raised in the United States. I have a tremendous network and family and friends. I can honestly tell you, I don't know a single U.S. citizen that would honestly say, I trust that my government has my interests at heart, or I trust U.S. politicians. We simply don't. And so, you know, there's a tremendous amount of frustration, even when it comes to, say, for the election. We like to pride ourselves that, yes, you know, we get to elect our president in the United States. And you'll often hear this for criticism against China. You know, in China, you're not allowed to elect your president. Well, actually, you know, I've spent a lot of time in China. Most people in China, they want a capable leader that actually has the skill set to lead that country into the future. When you go to China, you realize a lot of people are very supportive of the government. Why? Because they've seen the tangible benefits. They've seen the country transform over the past 30, 40 years and continue to get better. But in the United States, we see that situation actually deteriorating. We see
with all due respect, I mean, I think the Americans need to make a choice whether they want the nanny state, as they call it, or whether they want, you know, a responsible government that has some strategy for, let's say, 5 or 10 year term. Because, I mean, the Americans seem to want both sides of the deal, so to say, but it's like they have certain allegiance to, you know, historical values that were popular in their society a couple of centuries back. But, you know, the times have changed, but they're not ready to sacrifice those and, you know, shift their system in some other way. So I don't know how you're going to resolve this very difficult paradox.
You're spot on in your analysis, and I agree with you. I don't see a solution to this, and that's why I think a lot of people are very jaded at the election, for example. You know, even in these recent elections, you know, the presidential election, you know, we see voter turnout to be around 50%. I mean, we have half the country not showing up to vote because a lot of people don't really have, you know, it's kind of like the Republican Party, the Democrat Party, they're really the same. They're almost the same animal because, you know, at the end of the day, we know the military-industrial complex drives the United States economy, it drives the United States government. And so there's a lot of frustration. You know, you're right in that. Again, I almost look at it as a lot of Americans are trying to cope in the sense that, you know, we almost say to ourselves, well, at least we get to vote for our president. You know, we know the system will never change. We know that our government's never going to really do anything for us. But, you know, maybe it makes us feel better. Oh, at least we get to have a vote. But even that being said, you know, again, I don't see the tangible benefits for the Americans. I mean, we're looking at a healthcare crisis right now where, you know, healthcare could be potentially taken away from millions of Americans under Trump's potential new change. And so there's just a lot of, it's very difficult. There's a lot of changes because one president can completely switch things a different way. And, you know, we've seen that with Donald Trump and how he's changed his policies from Biden. You know, just for example, you know, we are not moving towards renewable energies in the United States. We're actually moving away from them. We're doubling down on fossil fuels. Whereas, you know, a country like China is saying, look, we know that renewable energy is the future. We want to invest in that. We want to become a carbon neutral country by 2060. You know, we're going to stay in the Paris Accords. We're going to move towards this direction. And meanwhile, Donald Trump has done the opposite, saying we're going to remove ourselves from the Paris Accords. We're not going to believe in climate change. Climate change is a hoax.
Well, there's a lot of inconsistency when it comes to specific policies, but there's one thing certain. The American debt problem keeps growing regardless of who is in charge. So there's at least some things that you can count on. You know, the ability to vote for a president who doesn't change much in tangible ways for the average American, and on the American debt problem to be getting higher and higher. Anyway, Cyrus, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Dr. Shashi Tharoor, welcome to Moscow. How crucial was Russia's support in India's early decades?
Mr. Khrushchev in particular opened up Indo-Soviet relations phenomenally. They helped India in everything from setting up the Bhilai steel plant to the whole business of cooperating with India's space programs. All sorts of things happened. The extraordinary success of the BrahMos missile. The Bra comes from the Indian Brahma, and the Mos comes from Moscow.
Hi, my name is Gamal Abdel Nasser, and I'm the grandson of the late Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was leader of the Egyptian revolution and the second president of the Arab Republic of Egypt. Abdel Nasser was a man who stood firm against colonialism and foreign domination and sought to find partners who respected Egypt's sovereignty. One of those partners was the Soviet Union. Egyptian and Soviet relations began to rise to its prominent height after Egypt failed to obtain an arms deal agreement with the United States and therefore negotiated and concluded an arms deal on fair and favorable terms with Czechoslovakia, then an important ally of the Soviet Union. The event triggered a strain between Egypt and Western countries and brought closer relations between Egypt and the Soviet Union. After the 1956 aggression, however, it had become clear to Egypt and the world, including the Soviet Union, that the United States, with its Israeli proxy, are interested in the region to inherit the British Empire, the region for its riches, be it land, waterways, fossil fuels, or even gold. It was perhaps this threat of inherited Western expansionism, among other reasons, that brought the Egyptian and Soviet relations closer and on mutual understanding and cooperation. As the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union prolonged, and the two superpowers of the time drifted apart culturally and civically, we could see an arms and technological race take place between the two powers. And as Egypt is modernizing and investing domestically in technology and manufacturing facilities, while facing a heavily US-backed Israeli military, stacking up inventory, a need is rising for heavier industrialization and bigger and better defense equipment in Egypt. Soon, the Soviet Union was heavily involved in Egypt's infrastructure construction and in the regular shipment of defense equipment. Egyptian-Russian relations have been strong prior to the 1952 revolution, had peaked throughout the 1950s and 60s, had stalled throughout the remaining half of the 20th century, only to come back strong throughout the first quarter of the 21st century. There seems to be a mutual respect for the national independence of each nation on all matters, without preconditioned dealings and unilaterally founded agendas. I believe it is on this dialogue, in an effort to understand and bring closer the opposing worldviews of nations, as well as engaging in fair and economic, industrial, or other collaborations, that governments can have better and growing relations for many generations to come. Thank you, and see you next time on RT.
Counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Cyrus Jansen, an American geopolitical analyst and YouTuber. Now, Cyrus, while the domestic results of Trump's economic policy are arguable, as we have discussed in part one, internationally, he's caused a lot of upheaval with his tariff policies. And I heard you say before that these tariffs are being used to interfere in other countries' internal affairs. Some have claimed that they directly infringe on their sovereignty. And yet we see country after country sending their trade delegations to Washington, hoping and trying to negotiate a better deal for themselves. Why do you think we haven't seen more principled or perhaps more coordinated position on the part of the global community or the global South in, you know, in opposition to this clearly abusive and domineering economic policy?
Well, I think a lot of the countries that are going to the White House, you know, you're going to be your closest United States allies, right? So, you know, so Canadians, you know, obviously the European Union, you know, even Japan, Korea, you know, they're just traditionally much more aligned, you know, closer to the United States. But I do see that we have a tremendous amount of growth and a lot of opportunity, you know, with China specifically being, you know, the second option here as far as, you know, world superpowers and trade. And you look at what China's done with the Belt and Road Initiative, you look at the BRICS organization and how that has gained a tremendous amount of momentum. And so I think there's a lot of other options on the table right now. And I think that we're seeing that, especially in Southeast Asia, you know, some of the most emerging and most powerful countries in the world, you know, as far as their economic growth, you know, shifting closer to China, actually, and other countries. And I mean, a big change was actually India. India was actually a remarkable change because, you know, for many years, India has always tried to, you know, have this policy of non-alignment where they're not aligning with any one country specifically. For example, we know that India has a good relationship with China, although there are some border tensions and other areas of conflict, but they've also had a good relationship with the United States. And as soon as, you know, Donald Trump started this tariff war against India, the first thing that Modi did, the prime minister, is he went to Beijing for the first time in 7 years and asked for a trade meeting, you know, with Xi Jinping specifically. So it's a very interesting thing because I think when you look outside of the United States and its traditional allies, and that's, of course, the global South, or as I like to call it, the global majority, many countries, whether it's Latin America and Brazil, Argentina, you know, moving closer to China. We look at certainly Africa, Southeast Asia, the Middle East. You know, there's a lot of opportunities for other trade that is not just reliant on the United States.
Now, you mentioned BRICS and Russia alongside China are the two founding members of this organization. And the interesting thing about BRICS is that up until recently, there's been a lot of talk about multipolarity. But I think for the most part, many countries prefer to sit comfortably on the fence as they see first Russia and to a lesser extent China confront the United States and its domineering practices directly. Do you think there is a chance, paradoxically perhaps, of Donald Trump of sort of bringing out the agency of more practical cooperation, not just paying lip service to multipolarity, but actually taking a more, you know, direct stance against, you know, some American practices and for what they actually believe and for what they want the global system to be in the future?
Well, I'm skeptical that Donald Trump would make that move because for most American presidents and for the U.S. government, there's always this policy of America first. And I always found it a very interesting thing, for example, when the U.S. president and our Secretary of State and any government official, when we talk to Europe, for example, the European Union, we'll say a message like, you know, your best foreign policy should put the U.S. interests first. And I just think that's such an interesting thing. You know, how can you as a European, you know, sign up for that and honestly go along with that saying that, you know, we need to put American interests first? No, the European Union should put the European Union interests first. Obviously, you want to have a great relationship with the United States for trade because the United States is an amazing economy. It is a great trading partner. But I would be very hesitant to work exclusively with them. You know, for example, I mean, we know that Germany's success was 100% related to the fact that they got cheap, energy from Russia. You know, this was an amazing partnership for Germany. This is what fueled Germany's economic growth for many years. And unfortunately, that relationship has now been severed. And what happens? The United States is saying, well, we'll sell you energy, but we're going to sell it to you at a price that is very high, much higher than you were paying before. And you're going to like it. And you're going to like it because we're the United States and we're going to tell you what to do. And Germany, unfortunately, is just willingly saying, okay, fine. You know, we'll just go along with that. But again, it's not serving Germany's interests. I think that, you know, one of the greatest things that I had heard in an interview was with Kishore Mahbubani, the great statesman from Singapore. And he said, the European Union has to figure out a way to work with Russia. The number one reason, because Russia's not going anywhere. Russia will always be the border, or will be on the border of the European Union. You know, geographically, the European Union and Russia are inseparable, right? Because they're located next to each other. So you need to figure out a way to work with Russia and to figure out a way to coexist and make that relationship happen. And so I think that was a really profound statement because, you know, the United States could say, you know what, we don't want to deal with Russia anymore. Well, you're on the other side of the world and we have other options. But Europe, you know, it's not the same.
I agree with you 100%. And yet when it comes to practical geopolitics, it's always hard to do that. And it's hard not only for the European Union, but even for China, for example, because recently you made a video about Russia and China being in talks of setting up this precious metal exchange where they could settle payments not only in gold, but also in rare earth materials. But this seems like a great idea, like on paper or in media, but when it comes to practical geopolitics, the Chinese have always been very tentative. They don't want to push the Americans too hard. Do you think Chinese strategic patience has already reached the tipping point when they can be a little bit more proactive in terms of not necessarily opposing the Western-led system, but at least creating something tangible themselves, the new kind of infrastructure that they and the rest of the world can also use?
Well, the biggest story this week in geopolitics is certainly China's change on its rare earth exports. And this is a very interesting thing because China's new policy is now that any country in the world, you know, if you are exporting rare earth minerals to develop 14 nanometer chips or below, you know, you essentially need approval from Beijing in order to get those elements. And so the interesting thing that I've seen is I've seen actually two things. Number one is the United States is trying to preach the message that this is China launching an economic war on the United States. Meanwhile, I see many countries and many people from the global South actually saying this is a great thing because this is actually going to limit, you know, what America can do, you know, specifically in regards to the military and its use of the military and its weapons around the world. Because obviously, the United States military, ironically, is very dependent on these Chinese rare metal exports. So I think that this was a very big move. That the answer to your question is yes. And I think that China made a very big move this week by passing this new law or this new rule that they're going to be starting to limit the amount of exports. And the interesting thing with this is that it doesn't violate the World Trade Organization policies because it's not an outright ban. China is not banning this. They're simply saying you need approval. So, you know, anybody can still get access to this. We just would like to have a say in what you're actually going to use this for. And so, again, I saw a lot of people praising this around the global South saying, you know, this is actually a great thing that China's doing because, you know, hopefully it's going to limit the United States' capacity, you know, to launch these military conquests and to, you know, effectively use the military industrial, you know, complex around many of the developing nations around the world.
I'm also hearing that there is a lot of support for this kind of more muscular moves among the Chinese themselves. And I heard you say in another interview that the Chinese have a special sort of nickname for Donald Trump, which roughly translates as the nation builder, meaning that they actually count on Donald Trump to pressure them enough to bring out their own ingenuity, their own creative way of solving these problems. And I think to some extent it applies to Russia as well. We were pressed into the corner and I think we used that opportunity to reinvent our own industries, our own way of being. Now, I want to ask you whether you think the West or the United States specifically have been able to capitalize on this animosity, on this increasing great power contest to revitalize themselves.
Well, I don't think they have because, you know, the interesting thing is this, you know, we go back 4 or 5 years ago when Joe Biden, you know, started off a policy of active containment. You know, we want to contain China's rise. We don't want to see them advance so fast technologically. And so what we're going to do is we're going to ban them from getting access to the most advanced microchips in the world. So in reality, this is the exact same thing that China is doing now. So China is really doing a tit for tat. You know, they are doing the exact same thing that the United States did to them, saying, look, we want to limit your ability as well. And we can do that with rare earth minerals. But the problem is that, when you look at semiconductors, okay, there's no doubt about it, right? It, you know, Taiwan, and we look at the United States, a company like NVIDIA that makes the GPUs, you know, they actually hold this technological advantage over China for the time being. But in the past 5 years, China has very quickly closed that gap. We think in the United States that, oh, guess what? We've banned them from getting access to these microchips. And our lead is so insurmountable. There's nothing that China can do. But China is a nation full of engineers, and it has a tremendous amount of assets that it can put behind a certain industry. So when it comes to AI or semiconductors, China's government is 100% behind that move towards developing these industries. And so that's where we've seen China been able to close the gap very, very quickly. And so again, my message that I always preach on YouTube and with my analysis is always that the United States and China, these are two massive economies. They have to find a way to work together. And so again, this is just another layer of the trade war that, you know, continues to get more and more complex. But again, I mean, we you know, the United States and China, neither are going away, neither are going to, you know, give up in this conquest. So it is, you know, how do we find a way to work together that can really serve humanity?
Let me ask you my final question on that, because I sometimes get an impression that the United States or the West more generally is simply sort of fearful of the fair competition, despite having a much higher industrial economic income base, that, you know, when it comes to other rising nations, that they simply cannot play when the rules are equal for all. What do you think about it?
I think it's very true. I mean, I think the United States, our goal from the United States government is always to be the hegemon, right? We want to be the number one superpower in the world. We definitely fear, you know, China rising and occupying that number two spot, and the number two spot that is quickly gaining up to that number one spot. So in the United States
mind— Why is that? Can you explain? Why is that? Because, I mean, you seem to have all the technology, all the ingenuity, entrepreneurial spirit, your famed democracy, what have you. You have all the ducks in the row. Why would you be fearful of any other competitor?
Well, I think the biggest thing, that the reason why the United States fears China, is that China has proved to the world that democracy is not the only model that can work. I'm not anti-democracy, nor am I pro-communist. I'm pro every country in the world finding a system that works for you. I do not think that a United States-style democracy would actually work and function in China. Now, you know, China has its own policy. It's its own independent country. So when I go to China, I observe. I observe what's going on there. But I think this is a big threat to the message that we are, that the United States is trying to preach, that, you know, in the United States, they preach the message that you can only rise and be successful if you are a true democracy. China has proven that that is an incorrect statement. Well, you can have a different political model and be successful.
Well, Cyrus, I'm not convinced that the American-style democracy works well even for the United States, but I guess it's a subject for another show. In the meantime, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me again.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.